From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm David Byrd reporting. The FBI is officially investigating Wednesday's massacre in California as a terrorist act. The assistant chief of the FBI's Los Angeles office, David Bowditch, said Friday a number of pieces of evidence, including signs the massacre was extensively planned, have turned up to indicate it was terrorism.
As of today, based on the information and the facts as we know them, we are now investigating these horrific acts as an act of terrorism.
Bowditch would not talk about the specific evidence, but he did say it includes crushed cell phones found in a garbage can near the site of the killings. The FBI agent said he had seen a Facebook posting where the woman involved in the massacre, Pakistani-born Tashfeen Malik, pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. That message was apparently posted on Facebook about the same time the shooting started, but Bowditch said he would not give any further information. Here in Washington, FBI Director James Comey said that there is no indication the couple was part of a terrorist network or cell system.
So far, we have no indication that these killers are part of an organized larger group or form part of a cell. There's no indication that they are part of a network.
Attorneys for the family of killer Syed Rizwan Farooq criticized the FBI's characterization as premature, saying that they have not seen solid evidence that either of the attackers was connected to terrorism. Malik and Farooq killed 14 people and wounded 21 others at a Christmas party held Wednesday in San Bernardino, California. The attackers were later killed in a gun battle with police. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Friday it might be possible for Syrian rebels and government forces to fight the Islamic State, even if Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is still in power. Speaking in Athens, Kerry said that all sides in the Syrian civil war will only cooperate in fighting to suppress Islamic State if they are confident that a mutually acceptable solution about the Syrian leader's future is in sight.
It is not clear that he would have to, quote, go. If there was a clarity with respect to what his future might or might not be.
Kerry said without a clear indication of Assad's future, it would be exceedingly difficult for rebels to cooperate against Islamic State because they would believe that they were helping and entrenching Assad. Turkish troops have entered Iraq for what U.S. officials say appears to be training exercises with Iraqi forces fighting Islamic State. A Turkish official told Reuters the troops were in the Mosul-Bashika region for routine training exercises. The troops crossed the border about 30 kilometers from the Islamic State-held city of Mosul. U.S. officials confirmed the move late Friday, saying one Turkish battalion had positioned itself on the Iraqi side of the border. Turkish media reported the deployment was part of a regular turnover. Germany's parliament has voted overwhelmingly to send military aid to fight Islamic State militants in Syria. Berlin will send Tornado reconnaissance jets, a frigate, refueling aircraft, and up to 1,200 military personnel to join the coalition against Islamic State. French President François Hollande had asked the international community to escalate the fight against Islamic State after the group claimed responsibility for last month's attack that left 130 people dead in Paris. The U.S. economy had a net gain of 211,000 jobs in November, while the unemployment rate held steady at 5%. Friday's government report says that job gains were seen in construction, professional services, and health care. John Lonsky is with Moody's Analytics.
There was a big addition of jobs in the construction industry. I was struck by that. Private sector services did quite well. And even though I think we had some weakness in temp employment, services still came in on the high side. Government employment was a little bit above trend.
The job gains are stronger than many economists expected and support the case for the U.S. Central Bank to raise a key interest rate later this month. The good employment news boosted U.S. stocks, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ all finishing trading up more than 2%. European and Asian markets were lower Friday. I'm David Byrd reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and for the first time on our show, Jerome Cartellier, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. And here are the issues. 2 weeks after terrorist attacks in Paris, world leaders convened in the French capital to tackle a graver threat to mankind, climate change caused by a steady rise in greenhouse gases. The British House of Commons voted 397 to 223 to authorize airstrikes in Syria against the group that calls itself the Islamic State. The vote followed the Obama administration's announcement that it would be sending more special operations forces to the region to destroy IS targets in both Iraq and Syria. The International Atomic Energy Agency released a lengthy report on the possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. The highly anticipated document concluded that Iran had a program to try to build nuclear weapons until 2003 and continued some research for 6 more years. And finally, in the United States, another day, another mass shooting, this time at a facility for disabled people in San Bernardino, California. 14 people were killed. The perpetrators, who died in a shootout with police, included a man who had worked at the facility and his wife. So, gentlemen, let's start in Paris. Jerome, let's start with the climate change conference. 175 countries came. They all came with their own plans to reduce emissions. How effective do you think this conference will be compared to previous ones?
I think we're in a very, very different situation to previous ones. The main point of reference would be Copenhagen Summit 6 years ago, which, as you may remember, ended up in a real fiasco. Basically, you had all the presidents and head of state arriving at the end and trying to nail down some sort of a couple of pages agreement, which didn't really go anywhere. We're in a very different situation this time around. I think the main reason being no country, no leader wants to be seen as the bad guy, as the one who's going to make the entire house collapse. And I think that's a key difference. Another difference is what happened a year ago in Beijing when President Obama went and met with the Chinese President Xi. Mm-hmm. And they basically agreed on some sort of a China-US climate agreement, one might call it, whereby China announced for the first time a target with a date, basically saying our emissions will peak by 2030. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. put forward their targets. And basically the message then was both China and the U.S. want an agreement in Paris in December. So I think with these two things in mind, I think we're in a very different situation than we were 6 years ago. I do believe we will end up with an agreement in probably mid-December. Now, what's exactly in the agreement remains to be seen, obviously.
Yeah. David, these pledges are voluntary, though. I mean, they're going to be put into agreement. Is there an enforcement mechanism or not really?
No, and we still see gigantic rows between the developing world who essentially say, you, the rich world, got rich by getting the right to pollute the atmosphere and burn carbon all of these, decades, centuries, and now you're trying to stop us joining you in the rich world club, so you need to compensate us. And that's clearly a sticking point. I think also, just because we're sitting here in Washington, to make a kind of American political point, Jerome is absolutely right that there is a consensus now between countries like America and China that we didn't see 6 years ago in Copenhagen. But let's not be kind of naive. That consensus is extremely fragile. We're here with a Democratic president who is at the very limits of his mandate, mm-hmm. in terms of committing America to taking sort of steps that will be seen as painful in America. If the next presidential election in America elects a Republican, then America will no longer be part of that consensus. It will be actively hostile to that consensus. If there were a different president, a Republican president, then there would be no deal of any sort, because we can see Republicans in Congress and every single one of the Republican presidential candidates taking the position at the moment that nothing must be done that hurts the American economy, and indeed in many cases expressing doubt that climate change even exists. So this consensus is incredibly fragile and could fall apart November next year, if a Republican is elected.
Yeah, one of the sticking points, Jerome, is that Congress doesn't want to appropriate money to give to poorer countries to adopt more climate-friendly policies and to adapt to climate change. So I think there's an element there, yeah.
Yeah, what's interesting is that the American side has been extremely careful. As you know, there's a whole debate around what part of the agreement should be legally binding. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not talking about a treaty, obviously, because it's a no-go area. It would have to go through Senate, and there's no chance it would get a green light there. So there's no treaty on the table. But there, what people are working on in Paris is some sort of a two-fold agreement. One part of the agreement would be about the process, about transparency, about reviewing targets, and that would have some sort of a legally binding element to it. The other part of the agreement would be where the numbers are, with finance, with targets, and this would not be legally binding. In other words, this would not, you know, you wouldn't have to ask Congress on that particular part. So I think that that's a key difference there.
There are polls, by the way, David, that show something like two-thirds of Americans actually would like a climate treaty.
Yeah, but those polls are completely meaningless. I get so frustrated and impatient with polls that say two-thirds of Americans think this or two-thirds. There is no room in America anywhere where two-thirds of the people in that room have that opinion. That poll is actually an umbrella over a poll that says 75% of Republicans totally do not believe in climate change, and about 67% of Democrats think that something should be done. But there is no American room in which two-thirds of people have that opinion. So it's a useless piece of information. I'm not attacking your kind of raising it, but it's...
I read it in the New York Times.
It's like gun control. It's like climate change. There is no electoral unit in this country, no state, no congressional district, where two-thirds of people hold that opinion, you know, in a way that will carry a national majority. This country is utterly, utterly divided on climate change along completely partisan lines.
Yes, among many other topics as well. But I'm going to stay with you, and I'm going to move to the Middle East and move to the group that calls itself the Islamic State and the British vote this week. I watched a lot of the debate. It was quite extraordinary.
It was a very dramatic debate. I mean, Parliament in Britain, you know, we're no longer the greatest country in the world by a long way, but we still have reasonably good parliamentary debates when we try.
Yeah.
This was, in some senses, it was an extraordinarily kind of dramatic debate for a very undramatic policy. There are British fighters and surveillance flights already over Iraq. This was to say that they could also fly over Syria. And one of the points that the British government made was there is essentially no meaningful border between the ISIS-held bits of Iraq and the ISIS-held bits of Syria. So it's a very artificial distinction to say that the Royal Air Force shouldn't be bombing on the Syrian side of that line. So that being so, and also the fact that, you know, we have no money, so we have no planes. I mean, you know, we have like 9 tornadoes or something. I think that's what's involved here. It's nothing. But what we're seeing is British politics tearing itself to pieces, and the opposition Labour Party still living with the legacy of the man, their former leader Tony Blair, leading them into a war in Iraq that's left, you know, gigantic political scars on the British political landscape. And we saw the opposition Labour Party split right down the middle, and that was why the vote went through. The Conservative government managed to get 67 members of the opposition to vote with them. Now, that sounds very parochial, but what you're seeing is a complete division within Europe about how to handle Islamic State.
Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Barbara Slavin with Jerome Cartelier and David Rennie. Jerome, the fight against ISIS, the Obama administration made clear that it's going to send another 100, 200 so-called special operators to the region. Is that important, or is that in line with the symbolic British contribution?
No, I wouldn't call it symbolic. What is sure, though, is that the Obama administration has clearly said we'll do more of the same. We're not changing strategy. You know, post-Paris attacks, Obama has been asked over and over again, you know, the equation has changed. Is this a turning point? Do you want to reconsider your policy? The short answer is no. What they're looking at now is saying basically we'll look at what is efficient. And they were obviously very happy with their previous operations by special forces, particularly when it comes to intelligence, where they were able to gather quite a bit of a significant intelligence. So they want to reinforce that. But again, there's no fundamental shift in the strategy here.
Well, I mean, more people entails more risk, though. And there also have been some reports, frankly, that Americans have been more active than has been reported in terms of working with the Kurds, being involved in a lot of these operations that have already taken place, certainly in northern Iraq.
I think that's been true across the whole piece. I mean, we have here, you know, debates in Washington about, for example, you know, the essentially utter failure of a Pentagon Department of Defense program to train rebels and to arm rebels in Syria. When you talk to American officials in private, they say, well, yeah, bear in mind that's the public stuff. But then there is a whole covert program. So the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, is you know, much more active, has many more rebels. Those rebels are more effective. And, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, paramilitary stuff going on. Jerome is absolutely right that the message from the White House is clear. That, you know, don't expect us to change course and accept that our strategy isn't working. We're just going to, you know, put a little bit more behind it to see if we can make it work. If you're an optimist, I think what you do here is one of the vulnerabilities of the Islamic State is their desire to have a state, that they're not just another terrorist group. The fact that they want to have a territory and to create this kind of pseudo-caliphate means they're vulnerable because you can take that territory away from them. There's a lot of talk about the Kurds as if they're magic in this town, that they're the kind of the ground forces that solve everything. But we need Sunni ground forces,
Sunni Arabs
to take Sunni Arab territory. And that, again, if you talk to officials in private, is their despair, that it's very, very hard to find them, to arm them, to get Iraqi government permission to do very much with them. That's the key.
Yeah, well, Ashton Carter, the defense secretary, said in Congress that, again, that we need Sunni Arab forces to take Sunni Arab land. And that would imply Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates. But, Jerome, they're busy to the extent that they are on the ground anywhere. They're on the ground in Yemen. And it's hard to see the Iraqis wanting Saudis running around in their territory. I don't think the Syrians would be that keen on it either. So where are these Sunnis to come from?
Well, that's obviously the thorny issue. That's the very difficult one. I do believe more broadly what the U.S. are aiming at and the coalition in general is kind of move forward diplomatically in Syria, because that's where you're going to, you know, you're going to potentially make a change.
Mm-hmm.
This has proven very difficult. President François Hollande, after the attacks, basically started a big diplomatic offensive. He came here to D.C., he went to Moscow. Look, not much has changed when it comes to Russia's position. The whole goal is having Russia shifting from defending Assad to attacking ISIL. And this has not exactly happened. Yes, there have been slight changes and they've been hitting a few ISIL targets.
He's been busy attacking Erdogan, the president of Turkey, lately.
That's for sure. That kept him busy. And that's actually what President Obama told him this week, basically telling the two of them, stop fighting with each other and turn your attention to ISIL. But again, to no avail so far. So.
Yeah. I'm going to switch to a favorite topic of mine now, David. That's Iran. The International Atomic Energy Agency came out with a very lengthy and detailed report on what's called PMD, the possible military dimensions of the Iranian nuclear program. Some aspects of it were surprising, some not. Did you have a chance to take a look at this document?
So I've only read the headlines rather than the whole document. I know that you are one of the few people in this town,
actually
not employed by the government, who has actually read the whole report. I mean, you know, the bottom line is it is slightly like going into the bar in Casablanca to verify that there was indeed gambling, and they have now discovered that there was gambling, and we are now all reeling around in surprise that there were military dimensions to this program. They did their job in terms of sealing that off. Does that give us more comfort that moving forward, when the Iranians cheat, as they surely will try and cheat again because they always do, that the mechanisms are there, that the IAEA will be seen as reliable and comforting by countries like America or Israel or others, the P5 countries? That you know much more about than I do.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there are a couple of things, and I will take the moderator's prerogative of reading the key overall assessment. Iran conducted, quote, a range of activities relevant to the development of a nuclear explosive device prior to the end of 2003 as a coordinated effort, and some activities took place after 2003. That's IAEA speak for, yes, they did have a nuclear bomb program. It was, a significant program before 2003. They got caught, of course, in 2002. And they scaled it back. They continued some research, computer work, computer modeling, and so on. But according to the IAEA, they stopped in 2009, which I found interesting because that was when Ahmadinejad was still the president of Iran. It was before the pragmatic Rouhani came in 2013. So apparently they did actually stop it, and there's no indication that they ever took any nuclear materials, enriched uranium, anything like that, and actually tried to use it to make a weapon. What they were doing was studies about how to make a warhead, testing of explosives that could be used in nuclear weapons, that kind of thing. And I think people were surprised that the IAEA really, was quite explicit in terms of how far they had gone and how far they hadn't gone. And as far as confidence going forward, This was all discovered before there was really extensive verification mechanisms available. Under this nuclear agreement that was recently signed, which will go into effect probably early next year, there is going to be tremendously, you know, effective, one assumes, verification, and in addition to all the national intelligence means that have always been used against Iran. So the consensus that I'm hearing is that, you know, this checks the box, we move forward, and we're in pretty good shape going forward. If we demanded that the Iranians, quote unquote, come clean and beg forgiveness for having done this research, then there would have been no deal. So that's the impression I get. Time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with David Rennie and Jerome Cartelier, and we're talking about the IAEA report and disputing whether there were particles of uranium found at a place called Parchin. This is a military site that the IAEA had long wanted to inspect. It finally got a chance to look at it again just a few months ago, but the container that had been used for high explosives testing had been moved or destroyed, so it was rather difficult for them
to find any traces. But the key thing politically here in Washington surely is, you know, we assume that the Iranians are going to cheat. They always have. They have an incentive to cheat. All countries that want a nuclear bomb lie on their way to one.
Whoa. I mean, how do we know they actually still want a nuclear bomb? I think you're making some assumptions.
Well, they want to put
here.
Themselves in a position to...
They are in a position. I mean, look, they can make a nuclear weapon. I think this report makes it very clear if they want to.
The big picture is, if you're trying to defend the deal going forwards here in Washington, you need to be able to say that the IAEA is a useful watchdog.
True.
Which knows how to do its job. So I think that the simple value of this report is if they had done something that looked kind of feeble and had said, well, we don't know, it's all very complicated, then the IAEA would have been just kind of dismissed going forwards as a sort of useless kind of appeasing kind of, you know, arm of the international community.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that this report was very important, maybe most of all for the credibility of the IAEA, which will be, of course, the organization that has to, you know, monitor and verify the new nuclear agreement. Although I noticed that some in Congress were already trying to defund the IAEA or prevent it from getting the additional funds it needs to do its job, which seems rather self-defeating. But I'm going to turn now, Jerome, to what has become all too common an occurrence in the United States. We have yet another mass shooting, this one particularly hideous. 14 people killed at a facility for disabled individuals, a social services facility in Southern California. A lot of questions about the couple that carried this out. They do have some links, it seems, to terrorist websites or whatever. But on the other hand, they look like, you know, a regular couple with a six-month-old baby, certainly not on any kind of terrorism watch list. And the man, in this case, worked at the facility and so might have had some grievances against coworkers. What are we to make of this, and what are we to make of the phenomenon in general in this country that practically every day we have a mass shooting?
No, we have obviously a mass shooting a bit of a different kind this time around, and it did show when President Obama came out in the Oval this weekend and talked about it and did mention, yes, it could be terrorism, it could be work-related, or it could be somewhere in between. In other words, you know, somebody who's disgruntled at work but has some links to, or minor links, or, you know, remote links to terrorist organizations. So, and he hinted at that, actually, during his short remarks. So I think we're kind of into new territories here, which is obviously a little worrying for where people like to, you know, to have clear categorization of what is a terrorist attack and what is, a mass shooting as we know it, I should say, sadly. So I think, yeah, we're entering new territories. And it was particularly telling that the president this week, when he talked in the Oval, had a slightly different tone when talking about gun control. We used at the White House to have him coming out and, you know, over and over again with a mix of anger and sadness and call for action with which you
he's
know
given
that
up,
doesn't really
he?
Go. He's pretty much given up on that. He called the Americans to have a real introspection and start thinking about the place of gun in American society. But he was not as forceful and as insistent as he was before. And I think it has to do with the motives again, which are still unclear and which do paint a slightly different picture than the one we're sadly used to in the U.S.
Yeah, David. While all of this was unfolding, the U.S. Senate once again rejected two gun measures that seem not only eminently sensible but absolutely essential given the terrorism threats that we face. They rejected background checks on people who buy guns at gun shows or on the internet, and they rejected legislation to forbid people who are on the FBI watch list for terrorism from buying guns and explosives. I mean, I'm trying to understand this, but I really am having trouble.
So here's how this unfolded this week. If like us, you're covering this as a reporter, we had the news that there was this mass shooting, 14 people were dead. We didn't know the names of the people who'd done it. And so there was a kind of mystery as to what the motives were. At that moment, very depressingly, you suddenly saw this completely binary partisan argument break out. So until we knew who they were, you had people on the Democratic side saying, we need gun control. This shows we need gun control. This country has more gun massacres than any other rich country in the world. It's insane. You had the right saying, we bet they're Muslims. They're going to be Muslims. They're going to be Muslims. Yeah, yeah. Then we found out they're Muslims. The man was from Pakistan, born in the U.S. He'd gone and found a wife in Saudi Arabia 2 years ago, brought her back to America. At which point, the conservative side just went, okay, no more talk about gun control. This is Muslim terrorism. We told you so. This is a win for us. We're in the driving seat of this one. The Democrats and the gun control crowd, keep quiet. And the Democrats and the gun control crowd, essentially, it was like, damn, it wasn't a kind of white supremacist.
We've lost
this one, so we can't talk about gun control. It's become that kind of binary. It was going to be either one of theirs or one of ours in this kind of tribal warfare mentality that we've got into.
Yeah.
And because they're Muslims and because... it's hard now to maintain it as a workplace incident because they were building, homemade bombs at home.
They had incredible
people
arsenal.
With a grievance at work do not generally build kind of 12 bombs in their basement.
They were armed with two assault rifles, two semi-automatic pistols.
Thousands of rounds of ammunition.
In their home they had thousands of rounds of ammunition. They had pipe bombs.
Yeah, they built 12 pipe bombs. So this is not a workplace grievance on the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
And I have to say a simple fact that the President of the United States in the Oval mentions the word terrorism, in spite of, he does say we don't know yet, but you do know that if you use the word in that setting, it does send a signal.
Yeah. Jerome, you're from France originally, yes?
Yes.
We all still mourn what happened in Paris on November the 13th. But 30,000 Americans die every year through gun violence. I'm sure the figures in France are minuscule compared to that.
Yeah, they obviously do not compare.
We have a history in this country, obviously, of people owning guns and hunting and using them for protection and pioneer spirit and so on. But the easy access to guns that can kill large numbers of people in a short amount of time surely is something that the founding fathers of this country never had in mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is striking is what someone has called the routine that mass shooting have become here. From a journalistic perspective, it is sometimes interesting to see that here, when you've been here for long enough, or when you look at the American media, some of these smaller mass shootings, if you could call them that, don't get that much attention because it has become again the routine and it's happening again. Whereas every time something like that happens, it got tremendous attention back in Europe, among others, because people still find that absolutely unbelievable.
And it's not going to change. There will be no meaningful gun control in this country. It's not going to happen.
Unless the Democrats win.
No, even then, it's never going to happen. If it was going to happen, it would have happened after the appalling massacre in Newtown in Connecticut, which, we saw, dozens of children gunned down in a nursery school, in a primary school in Connecticut. Nothing changed. Nothing's ever going to change on this because it's about the people who want their guns. It gives them power. It gives them the confidence that they are the sort of heroic individual who will protect their family and keep the tyranny at bay. And it's a form of kind of armed narcissism, which is so potent that you're never going to get those guns
well,
out of their hands.
David, I disagree with you, but that's all the time we have. And joining us today were David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Jerome Cartellier, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. The program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for El Monitor. Thanks for listening.